Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we'll be in Sudan to discuss one of the worst massacres of civilians since the war began. From Botswana, what do young voters want in an election that promises to be much more closely fought than those that came before?
I want to see an increase in youth engagement and representation, with more young voices not only heard but influencing policy decisions. I'm looking for a government that prioritizes economic opportunities for young people and one that values transparency to build trust in governance.
And what can be done to stop the deadly toll from petrol tanker accidents in Nigeria?
First of all, the roads need to be fixed. Then the general public need to be sensitized to ensure that they get to know the articulated vehicles, especially those that carry highly inflammable products. But at the same time, also the drivers of those articulated vehicles, they should be more careful where they go, how they go, and when they go.
It's Tuesday, the 29th of October. First, we go to Sudan. This is the sound of an attack being launched. The conflict in Sudan has now reached a devastating peak, with one of the deadliest attacks on civilians recorded so far. Since Friday, Al Jazeera State has faced relentless violence as more than 100 civilians have been killed. According to pro-democracy groups, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, are responsible for raiding Al Sireha village in the state. Disturbing images of bodies being prepared for burial and mass graves have been widely shared online. The Secretary General of the United Nations is calling for accountability.
I am horrified by the Rapid Support Forces' continued attacks against civilians in Al-Fashir and surrounding areas, which include displacement sites where famine conditions have been confirmed. The perpetrators of serious violations of international humanitarian law must be held accountable.
Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, briefing the Security Council on events in Sudan. Sudan's army chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has accused the RSF of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The RSF denies this, claiming they only clashed with tribal militias aligned with the army. The Sudan Armed Forces are also accused of committing atrocities against civilians. It's difficult for humanitarian workers to reach people in the area due to shelling and sniper fire attacks. We know this is a war and terrible things happen and are done during war. But what brought on this attack of villages in Al Jazeera State? Richard Kagoe, a name you should recognize as a regular listener to Focus on Africa, has been following events and he's been explaining how the situation unfolded.
There's been a wave of violence. So maybe you would describe it as a campaign of violence by the Rapid Support Forces starting from October 20th to the 25th. What has happened is in Gezira State, specifically to the east of the state, where we have close to about 30 villages, you know, these are farming communities. What the RSF did is that they started attacking homes, looting markets, businesses, and are also setting farms on fire. Unfortunately, in the course of that, around 124 people, this is just provisional, lost their lives and thousands were injured in the process. So this is basically something what analysts are describing as a strongest signal in terms of escalation of violence, which is now targeting civilians in different parts of Sudan. And that's very worrying.
Entire families have been wiped out in Jazeera State. Why is the RSF targeting civilians in this way?
From what we're hearing, that this latest wave of violence was triggered by the defection of a senior RSF commander who was previously an army officer in the Sudanese army. So when we had the conflict starting off on April 15th last year, he became the regional commander in Al Jazeera State. So in the process through his defection, which happened to be two Sundays ago, then the violence flared up starting off Monday on October 20th. What they're saying is this could be revenge attacks or retaliatory attacks against communities which are said to be aligned or associated with this former commander, because if you look at the areas which were targeted, this was mostly towards the east of Gezira State and Al-Butana area where this particular commander hails from. So that's the preliminary analysis that has been given in terms of why the RSF conducted these attacks in this area.
I would imagine that it's also a way of warning other commanders who may be thinking of defecting to the other side. But we're also hearing that rescue efforts are being disrupted because humanitarian workers are being shelled and there's sniper fire as well.
It's true, Audrey, because I was listening to the Sudanese Doctors Union and a couple of volunteer groups which really have stepped in to assist, in the absence of the state with humanitarian response. And so it's become very difficult, especially from Friday through to Saturday, to evacuate people who had been wounded as a result of the attacks. We haven't been able to establish the numbers, but you're hearing of upwards of 200 specifically in one village. So it's difficult for them to bring out these people, because even the hospitals that would have handled emergency situations have all been closed because of the prevailing security situation there. So that's really been quite a difficult situation for the first responders and for the people who have been intervening during emergency situations.
Social media are awash with images of mass graves and burials. It must be seriously affecting the people of Sudan who are going through these difficulties, who are going through these atrocities. Just tell us a little bit about what you know of what's out there.
Yeah, Audrey, I managed to see a couple of clips and images when this story broke out. And in one instance, I was seeing people who are suspected to be RSF soldiers at the back of this truck. They're commandeering men and, giving them instruction, perhaps some of them being told to say God is great. And, being subjected to very humiliating treatment in the course of this. In fact, at one point I saw an old man, with long beards, and he was being held by this soldier who was trying to pull him from the ground, lifting him up using his beard. So those are the kind of images that you see. But then we haven't been able to, independently verify some of these images to determine the authenticity. But what we're hearing is that especially men, are being humiliated, perhaps in an attempt either to cause them to come out of these particular areas to flee. We've seen now reports of women, being raped or subjected to all forms of sexual violence. So it's a very troubling, a very desperate situation. And there's so much despondency among the local population there who feel so helpless.
General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan is accusing RSF of genocide and ethnic cleansing. Genocide is meant to trigger to the world a particular response. How is it likely to affect international efforts to mediate peace in Sudan that these accusations are being leveled against the RSF?
Maybe perhaps is to send a message in terms of the gravity of atrocities that are being committed by both parties. Because if you listen to Burhan's message, which he posted out on X this past week, what he said is that the RSF have been targeting specific communities. So it's not just the general population, but the RSF has dismissed those allegations because they're saying the people they have been fighting, these are specifically volunteer groups and, like tribal militias who have been armed or being supported by the Sudanese military intelligence. But then I think this leaves the lead on the extent to which both parties have gone in terms of escalating the violence and now why civilians have been caught, especially unarmed civilians who have been now caught in the crossfire. So I think it's a dire situation, and that's why the UN Secretary General has described the humanitarian situation, the current crisis, as a humanitarian catastrophe. That's what he says, that this is what people are being subjected to. This is what they're living through.
They've been living through this for well over a year now, and then you have escalation after escalation. Just remind us of the figures, the casualties, the fatalities, the numbers of displaced people, because I think that we don't have a clear idea of what's going on.
what we're seeing right now, the UN Secretary General said that 25 million people are in dire need of food assistance. So majority of the people who've been forced to flee from their homes because they fear for their lives, most of them are now distributed across various camps for internally displaced people across Sudan. And Audrey, the difficulty has been in terms of quantifying the numbers of those that have been affected, because these are people who have been, displaced across the country. The hardest hit regions have been especially the Darfur region, where the RSF has, a lot of control after they gained territory from the Sudanese army. So the figures do vary, but we're looking at upwards of hundreds of thousands in terms of deaths, and we're looking at upwards of 11 million who have been displaced. And now what I was saying, 25 million in dire need of food assistance.
That's Richard Kagoe, BBC Africa editor. The last time we spoke about Botswana here on Focus in Africa, we marveled at the fact that the country had never borrowed money from the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. Not that it hadn't borrowed money, just that it hadn't borrowed money from the main credit providers in the world. Today, we're talking about Botswana again. And we're marveling at the fact that it has never had serious electoral disputes in its history as an independent country. But that might change with elections due to be held tomorrow, because there seems to be real competition between at least two of the contenders. President Mokgweetsi Masisi is standing for a second and final term against three other challengers. His organization, the Botswana Democratic Party, has governed since independence from Britain in 1966. These students from the University of Botswana gave their thoughts on what they wanted to see in a new government.
I think a lot of young people are looking for change. I don't know how drastic the change might be, but when we look at the presidential debates, the honesty that was coming through when we look at how education is being affected, how healthcare is being affected, how the economy is being affected, is should be a great start for us as Botswana to be able to continue to have those conversations post-election.
I want to see an increase in youth engagement and representation, with more young voices not only heard but influencing policy decisions. I'm looking for a government that prioritizes economic opportunities for young people as we face challenges in employment and entrepreneurship, and one that values transparency to build trust in governance.
My main worry as a final year student is how am I going to make a living for myself? And second would be the policies of which they aim to implement with regards to business, because I'd also like to venture into businesses such as horticulture as well as real estate.
Those were voices from students in Botswana at the university. Zibani Maondeni is Professor of Politics at the University of Botswana. We began our conversation with the electoral history of the country.
We held our first elections in 1965, and we have been holding elections every 5 years until now. And all of them have been peaceful elections, so peaceful that almost all international observers declared them free and fair. And of course, we have also had presidential successions, but mainly from the same party. In short, one political party has been winning all these elections, but under different presidents. We've had President Sretse Khama, we've had President Kwaet Masiri, we have President Festus Muhaye, we've had President Ian Khama, we've had President Eric Masisi. We don't know who is coming next.
Right. So in that sense, Botswana is pretty much the way other African countries are, in the sense that the country that was there at the dawn of the liberation of the country, Botswana was a British protectorate until that point, 1965. The ruling party, or the founding Republic Party, is in charge, and it's the case in Botswana now. And of course, we should also point out that Ian Khama was the son of Sir Seretse Khama, the first president. These elections appear to be quite closely fought, is it?
Yes, they are. You remember that Ian Khama retired in 2018, and immediately after he retired, his successor sacked him from the ruling party. In other words, Ian Khama was expelled from the ruling party and he immediately joined opposition politics. He has formed his own party, the Botswana Patriotic Front, and he's busy campaigning around the country. So it's a first in Botswana's history that a retired president joins the opposition instead of campaigning for the ruling party.
And the candidate for the Botswana Patriotic Front is Miphato Riatile. Tell us a little bit about the other candidates, including Mr. Riatile. Which parties do they represent and what do they offer the people of Botswana?
First, you have Miphato Riatile of the Botswana Patriotic Front. In some sense, they feel that the current BDP is corrupted. And they believe that the BDP has lost the direction and their mission is to restore the BDP in some sense, a new version which they call the Botswana Patriotic Front. I think basically that's what they stand for. And of course, because Ian Khama is their main supporter, they believe in hunting ban, they believe in protection of wildlife, as well as creating new sources of living in agriculture and things like that. And then you have the BCP, Botswana Congress Party, under Dumelang Salashando. He is the son of a former MP and the son of the founder of the BCP. They call themselves the Jobs Party, that if they get elected into office, their main focus will be on creating jobs, largely for unemployed graduates, and they have devised a formula of how that will happen. They promise inefficiency in the government will come to an end, corruption will come to an end, and they will invest money in job-related activities. Then you have the Umbrella for Democratic Change under Duma Boko. Duma Boko is a lawyer by training. He has been in politics for quite some time, a harsh critic of the BDP. But of course, as an umbrella, it means there are different political parties under a coalition. And for some reason, the coalition has not always been stable. We believe stability within the coalition has contributed to its poor performance in the election. Whether this time they will do better, we are not sure. And then you have the BDP under Mkhwetsi Eric Masisi. He wants to continue where he left off. In other words, continue BDP policies, being tough on the BS. He started a renegotiation of the Botswana DBS bill, and he's demanding a lot from DBS, and this makes DBS uncomfortable.
We should point out to, for the benefit of our listeners, that Botswana is a diamond-rich country. Most of its foreign income comes from diamonds, and De Beers is the company that, in coalition with the Botswana government, that mines those diamonds and sells them, right?
Yes.
Was the feeling that De Beers was getting more out of the deal than Botswana and Botswana were getting from it up to now?
That's what a BDP under Masisi believes. Remember, the BS came into the country many years ago through President Sretse Khama, who was then leader of the BDP. The company has forged a close link with Botswana as well as with the Khama family. And this Masisi does not like. He's trying to break the link between the BS and the Khama family. Whether it will work for him or not, we are told already, since the deal expired last year, efforts to renew it have not been successful. In other words, there's no present deal between the BS and Botswana. And actually, there was a presidential debate the other day. That's when it was revealed there is no deal existing between the BS and Botswana. That's sort of scary because for the last 10 months, the BS is not buying Botswana diamonds and the country's revenues have gone down at a time when the BDP government is spending. And this is very worrisome.
Does it work in the favor of the current president and the party that the deal is hanging in the balance?
It doesn't work for them. They may have miscalculated, actually. They thought they could arm twist the BS, and it doesn't seem to be working for them because the BS is refusing to sign the deal as it is.
But could it be a vote winner? Because lots of people, not necessarily Botswana, but lots of Africans feel that the deals that were signed or that are signed between multinational companies and their governments don't favor the people of the country. And very often, if a government talks tough against a multinational company, it often wins them votes from especially young people.
Not this time. Not when the finances are low and people are not sure whether they will be paid next month or not. It's a very, very dangerous scenario that we are in right now. The country can easily collapse.
So is that the main issue in the election, or is it about jobs? Is it about, you know, proper governance and, you know, all the other issues that confront other countries as well?
The issue here is that Masisi's government does not respect confidentiality. Whatever they discuss with the BS in secret comes out in public and exposed. They see him as a reckless person who you cannot negotiate with. And of course, the jobs issue is also a major. We are running a jobless economy. Every year we are producing graduates who find no employment. And this is a worrying trend. Corruption has gone up since the COVID lockdowns. People have the belief that while we were all locked down in our houses, the government was busy looting the public funds. There was a former Minister of Finance, BDP Minister of Finance, during the lockdown, who estimated that 35% of public money was being lost through corruption and waste.
Is this going to be the election that kind of challenges Botswana's reputation as a stable democracy?
No, I don't think so. I think it brings Botswana into coalition government. There is a high chance that no party will win the required seats to govern by itself. And that automatically would compel the parties to start negotiating between themselves. Whether two parties or three parties will go into government will depend on the result after the election.
That's Professor Zibani Maundeni in the Politics Department at the University of Botswana. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. There have been deadly fuel tanker explosions in both Uganda and Kenya in the last few days. But just 2 weeks ago in Nigeria, over 170 people were killed after they rushed to the scene of a fuel tanker crash to collect leaking petrol. This happens a lot, and it's been happening for years. So why is no one fixing it? Let's discuss some of the reasons why these fuel tanker accidents appear to be happening more often and what can be done to stop them. Alhaji Yusuf Lawal Othman is the national president of the Nigerian Association of Road Transport Owners, which is an umbrella organization of all commercial vehicle owners involved in transporting petrol, people and cargo. Their operations span the entire West Africa sub-region. Why do so many people die in these accidents?
Well, there are a lot of factors involved. Usually, we forbid night driving. The drivers are not allowed to drive in the night because some roads are terribly bad. Two, because of the traffic, the drivers get fatigued, and it is expected they rest somewhere so that they avoid all these unforeseen instances. Three, the general populace, their reaction towards these articulated vehicles need to change because this is highly inflammable product. So any vehicle that is coming across it, not only vehicle, humans and whoever need to be careful. Like the one that happened in Port Harcourt about 3 to 6 months back, the tipper was moving, rushing, trying to swerve, and he went and hit the truck loaded with petroleum product, and of course it busted. So there has to be necessary care taken in terms of relationship with the truck loaded with highly inflammable product.
But don't you think, though, that it's also the other way around, that a truck carrying a highly inflammable substance needs to be even more careful than anybody else on the road?
Absolutely, you are right. So it's both ways. The driver has to be careful. He should not drive with fatigue. He should have a good rest. And sometimes a driver will load and will be on a queue for 10, 12 hours. Some of these roads are terribly in bad shape. So trying to squeeze and fast through a route, the truck loaded with product and other cars and other vehicles trying to pass through a single lane or whatever with impatience and fatigue usually leads to all these unforeseen circumstances.
Now, we are talking about this because the latest accident happened where a fuel tanker explosion in northern Nigeria killed over 170 people, and many of them, as you say, scooping petrol off the road. But this particular driver was handling this very dangerous vehicle with a very dangerous substance in the dead of night. And you said that drivers shouldn't drive at night, but this one clearly was. Are you able to enforce the rules and guidelines that you've set out?
Yes, we try to enforce. Even we are working assiduously now with relevant government agencies in order to ensure that that is in place. Apart from driving in the night, the driver passed through speed bumps with speed and the highly inflammable product. So the tank and the trailer separated, and that led to the truck to fall down and, of course, the spillage of the product. And the general public came and started scooping. So that was actually what happened.
But it's not the first time that an articulated truck of that size carrying fuel would have passed on that road. You all know how dangerous the roads are. You know that the driver shouldn't be driving at night. So why does it still happen? Was there anything else involved? Let's look at systemic reasons why this is the case.
Systemic reason is to avoid night driving completely. We enforce it. We should enforce it. Again, also, some vehicles can maybe 10, 15 years in operation. There is no enough resources to replenish and even service the vehicles. So some of them are obsolete vehicles. So all these things we are putting in place to ensure that we avoid all these kind of incidences. So there are a lot of factors involved.
Okay, so let's talk about you as an owner of 80 vehicles. How well do you pay your drivers?
Well, we try to pay them commensurate with what is being paid in the country locally, and we try to give them allowances per trip, per transaction. But I must confess to you, there are a lot of factors involved in this business that we call our own business, and we need to rejig it and ensure that we are well remunerated, so that will also remunerate the people that are working for us.
So you're saying really that they're not paid very well, and that you don't get paid very well for the commodity or for the use of your truck either?
Yes, especially now. There are a lot of factors involved because, you see, we need to look at the transportation itself, because in their developed countries or developing countries, there are a lot of factors. If you hire me as a contractor to give you transportation service, it is expected that once I bring the vehicle, I key in, I log in, I'm expected to be loaded within certain time frame. And of course, if I'm loaded, I'm similarly expected to deliver within certain time frame. By the time I get to the destination, I'm expected to discharge within certain time frame. I'm similarly expected to be reimbursed for that transaction within certain time frame. All those things that I've said are not in place. We are now trying to put them in place in order to have seamless operations. So there are a lot of factors involved.
Why only now? Nigeria has been an oil producer for decades.
I'm not talking about oil only. I'm talking generally about transportation in the country. Why now? Because it has just deregulated. Before now, government pays for the transportation of petroleum products. And in June last year, the transportation is no longer in the government hands, it's in the private individuals. So this is the time for us to make sure all these things are in place.
Let's talk again about the realm of possibility. What do you want the government to do to make the lives of you as an owner of vehicles and somebody who employs drivers to make accidents less frequent, but also to protect civilians who, when they see a tanker turned over, rush to go and get petrol? What do you think needs to be done?
First of all, the roads need to be fixed to a very large extent. Then the general public need to be sensitized to ensure that they get to know the articulated vehicles, especially those that carry highly inflammable products. But at the same time, also the drivers of those articulated vehicles, they should be more careful. They should be careful where they go, how they go, and when they go, to avoid all these unforeseen incidences.
And are you able to check on your drivers to make sure that they're okay and that they're following the regulations to ensure that they reach the end of the journey alive?
Yes, we do. We do as much as possible. But like I told you, in every human activity, you have some bad eggs. But to a very large extent, the majority adhere to the rules of the game.
So what do you do to check up on them?
Well, from time to time, the drivers' union and the owners' union, we have established even some driver health insurance. And we also have established a driver's welfare scheme, where after a certain time, is it 6 months or 1 year, accident-free bonuses. If drivers do not have accidents, they are paid some bonuses.
And this health insurance, also drivers get checked. They take them to the hospital. There are hospitals spread across the country. If the driver is ill or not feeling well, you can rush to the hospital and get checked. At the same time, also the vehicles themselves are being accessed every 6 months, depending on the company you are working for. They have driver training institute and they have vehicle inspection where they check the quality of the vehicle every 6 months and they give report based on the report that the vehicle is either put on road or off the road.
Okay, so tell me, as a salary, how much would somebody get per month?
Well, on the average, he gets about 100,000, which is above the minimum wage. 100,000 is about $70.
So $70 a month?
Yes.
Wow, that's not a lot.
It's a function of what you are being paid.
And is that the flat salary without allowances?
No, there are allowances attached to that. Like I said, every transaction, there are allowances. Every movement, there are allowances. There are some also that are not paid salary. Rather, they are paid allowances. That will spur them to make more trips. Because there are some drivers, if you give them salary, they can go afford to go and sleep or tell you the vehicle is off the road or whatever.
Is it a profitable business for you?
It used to be, but now it is not. We are stuck into it anyway.
Alhaji Yusuf Lawal Othman, the national president of the Nigerian Association of Road Transport Owners. Focus on Africa is the sum total of the efforts of Nyasha Michelle, Amy Leibovitz, Bella Hassan and Victor Silva. Joseph Keane is our senior journalist in charge. The technical producer was Nick Randell. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown and we'll talk again next time.